Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. NPR is reporting this morning that there's a big concrete sign, not just speculation, that Robert Mueller is done with his investigation. The sign is that the most prominent of all his deputies is leaving. That's Andrew Weissman, the much respected and much feared expert in financial fraud, who NPR says is leaving Mueller's office to take a position at NYU. And of course, a major financial fraud piece of the Mueller probe ended yesterday when Paul Manafort was sentenced in a Washington federal courtroom. It was the second time, as you probably heard, in less than a week that the president's former campaign chairman was sentenced for a range of crimes connected with his political operative work in Ukraine and money laundering here in the United States. All told, Manafort could serve over 7 years in prison. Even with that sentence, Manafort's lawyer, Kevin Downing, came out of the courtroom yesterday and announced that the trial had been a success based at least on one important criteria, no collusion. Listen to Manafort's lawyer and listen to how he's contradicted by a protester.
What I'm about to say will not be a surprise. Judge Jackson conceded that there was absolutely no evidence of any Russian collusion in this case. So that makes two courts have ruled no evidence of any collusion with any Russian.
That's not what she said.
Hear the protester at the very end say, "That's not what she said." Well, the she was Judge Amy Berman Jackson, and what she said was that in the hearing, quote, "The no collusion mantra is simply a non sequitur. The no collusion mantra is also not accurate because the investigation is still ongoing," end quote. Well, then why did Manafort's lawyers say no collusion? Like that was the central result of the sentencing, because maybe, just maybe, a certain someone with a certain pardoning power would be listening. Well, those dreams could be dashed, because almost immediately after Manafort was sentenced in federal court, Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance announced a new indictment here in New York. Remember, a president cannot pardon anyone for state crimes, only federal crimes. So here in New York, Manafort now stands accused of residential mortgage fraud, falsifying business records, and conspiracy connected with a Soho apartment he owned. Now, 2 years ago, our very own Andrea Bernstein and Ilya Meretz were among the first journalists to report about this Manhattan apartment for their Trump Inc. story, Manafort's Puzzling Real Estate Purchases. So with me now is half of that awesome Trump Inc. team, WNYC Senior Editor for Politics and Policy, Andrea Bernstein. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Brian.
And along with her for the legal view is Jennifer Rogers, former federal prosecutor with the U.S. Attorney's Office here in New York and now at Columbia University as a lecturer at the law school. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks. Good morning.
So, Andrea, tell us what those Manhattan purchases were and why the Manhattan DA is alleging criminal activity in connection with them.
So this particular Manhattan apartment is something that, so just to sort of go back to 2017, mm-hmm. Ilya and I were like, okay, this is a brand new president. We should start looking around in the land records of who lives in his building, Trump Tower. And we got to 43G. This is Paul Manafort's apartment. And so we thought, oh, there's a very strange pattern. He buys it under a shell company with all cash, meaning no financing. Then he puts it into his own name, and then he borrows against it. So I thought, oh, what is that? Let's see what else he owns. So we look up all of his apartments in ACRIS, which is the land record system online. We find an apartment in Soho on, well, it's sort of like where Chinatown and Soho meet, on Howard Street. And it has the same pattern. Bought by a shell company, turned into his name, he gets a bank loan. And there's another one in Brooklyn. And we talked to a number of experts, including current and former law enforcement people, who said, wow, that sure looks like that could be money laundering. So we did not know about Ukrainian oligarchs at this time. We didn't know about secret accounts in Cyprus and in the Grenadines. All we knew was there was this pattern of New York real estate purchases that raise suspicions. One of those apartments, the one on Howard Street, is at issue in this new Cy Vance indictment. Now, to be clear, reading through the indictment, it looks like a great deal of this evidence has been surfaced already in the trial in the Eastern District of Virginia. And basically what the charges are is that Manafort committed mortgage fraud because, among other things, he was renting this out as an Airbnb property, but he deliberately hid that from the bank because the bank would give a different kind of a rate for a rental as a primary residence. So he was charged. Evidence came out in the Virginia trial, but the jury deadlocked on some of the charges regarding this apartment, and that may turn out to be significant. Now, just a little asterisk about that deadlock. The jury convicted Manafort in Virginia of 8 of 18 counts, and one of the jurors gave an interview to Fox News and said that on the rest of the counts, it was 11 to 1 to convict. So there seemed to be some certainty, but the uncertainty is sort of what may have led Vance to actually charge this case, because there's a gray area about whether he was convicted, about whether there's still more justice to be done. So that's the apartment at issue. I mean, obviously, Vance cannot charge for a building in Brooklyn. So he has gone forward and he has said Manafort has committed these crimes, which are, if he were convicted of them, serious economic crimes for which President Trump could not pardon Paul Manafort.
So, Jennifer Rogers, let me go right to your law professor's view on the question of double jeopardy, which a lot of listeners are probably asking themselves about already, if they're even familiar with double jeopardy. Is Manafort's defense likely to claim double jeopardy, that you cannot be charged twice for the same crime, and that based on everything Andrea just laid out, that these New York charges are similar to ones that Manafort just faced in federal court?
Yeah, so first of all, they absolutely will be claiming double jeopardy without question. Essentially, usually two separate sovereigns can charge the same crimes because the federal government and the state government are separate. So usually New York could charge anything they wanted, even if someone had actually been convicted on a federal charge for the same thing. But New York has its own law, a stricter double jeopardy law, that says you cannot do that except in certain enumerated circumstances if the facts are the same. So you can't charge someone for the same bank robbery or, here, bank fraud if the jeopardy has attached in another proceeding. Now, what Andrea was alluding to is jeopardy attaches when a jury is sworn in a case, but because some of these counts were the subject of mistrials, meaning the jury didn't reach a verdict and so the judge declared a mistrial, the federal government had the right to retry him. So that may mean that jeopardy has kind of unattached. So that's kind of going to be part of the legal argument that the DA will make here when this is undoubtedly litigated. The other issue, of course, is going to be is whether these underlying crimes are factually the same or not. And it's not going to be the case that that's true for all of the counts, because they have some kind of financial books and records counts here in New York State that were not charged federally, but some of them do look like they are the same, that they are actually factually charging the same conduct, the same risk of harm, the same banks were involved, et cetera. So there's going to be a real battle over double jeopardy. It's a matter of state law in New York, so it'll be the state court in New York that will decide that question. We may have appeals on that question all the way up to the higher courts in New York State. So I do think it's going to be the subject of much litigation. So, you know, we won't see a resolution in this case certainly for some time.
And how much were you surprised, Jennifer, by the timing of those new indictments? Like, how would you, when you were a federal prosecutor, have felt seeing these Manhattan DA charges announced literally minutes after your federal case ended in sentencing?
Yeah, well, as a federal prosecutor, I would have been grateful that they waited. You know, sometimes you don't have that kind of cooperation, and you wouldn't want a state case to interfere with your federal case. So it was smart of them and good of them to wait until the federal sentencing was done. To do it within, I mean, I think it was like an hour of the judge's announcement of sentence, you know, it did look a little bit like, you know, twisting the knife a little bit, you know, don't relax for a moment, we're coming for you. But the truth is they did, they should have waited, and they did wait until the sentence was announced. You know, could have been a day or two later, didn't have to be an hour later, but they've had a sealed indictment, so they don't really want to sit on that for very long. It is important that they unseal that fairly promptly, although, again, not necessarily within an hour or whatever it was.
And Andrea, for you, not only as a Manafort business and Trump business expert, but for you as a political reporter, how much do you think Vance's move, including the timing, was politically motivated, that he's piling on to Manafort while he's down as a signal to the Democratic base that, hey, I'm not going to let Trump get away with even any potential pardon here?
So I don't like to jump into people's heads, but let me just sort of roll back to yesterday, late morning, early afternoon, and we in the newsroom were watching all the dispatches from the courtroom in Washington and calculating, okay, he's getting 43 months non-concurrent. How long is his total jail sentence? And while we're doing the math, the news comes over the transom that there's Vance with another indictment. This was practically before Manafort's lawyer had the time to make the comments that you played at the top of the segment. And they're not unrelated, because Manafort has pleaded guilty, his lawyers cannot appeal the sentence. Manafort agreed to accept whatever sentence was opposed to him. So in the Washington and Virginia cases, there's only one way to make those sentences go away, and that way is a pardon by Donald Trump. And the words that Kevin Downing said, no collusion, there's one person who cares about that. And what we learned from Michael Cohen when he testified last month is that there's a lot of signaling in Trump world about what are the right words to use, what are the ways to get into favor with Donald Trump. In fact, the special counsel's office in a court hearing argued to Judge Amy Berman Jackson that they were concerned that Paul Manafort, through his actions, was angling for a pardon. So all of that is in the mix. And at one point yesterday, there was a question about if President Trump was going to do this, when would he do it? And this is the moment at which Vance comes in and says, well, I'm indicting him. So if you're President Trump or you're Manafort's legal team and you hear, okay, there's more legal trouble, then you have the same problem that President Trump has had thus far, which is that if he pardons Manafort, he's getting in the sort of muck of obstruction of justice. So it is entirely possible that Vance took all of that into account when he timed the announcement. As Jennifer mentioned, the indictment was already voted earlier this month by the grand jury, but the timing of the press release was 100% controlled by Vance.
My guests are WNYC's Andrea Bernstein, co-host of our Trump Inc. podcast, and Jennifer Rogers, former federal prosecutor here in New York, now a lecturer at the Columbia University School of Law. We can take your phone calls, listeners, questions or thoughts on the sentencing of Paul Manafort yesterday, the Manafort case to date, the charges brought against him yesterday right after that federal sentencing by the Manhattan DA, Cy Vance, and also even this exclusive NPR report that they were touting on Morning Edition today, that there's a big concrete sign that Robert Mueller is done with his investigation, the sign being that the most prominent of all his deputies is leaving, Andrew Weissman, the much respected and much feared expert in financial fraud. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Jennifer, on Manafort's lawyer coming out to the press after the trial that had nothing to do with collusion and saying the big takeaway is there was no collusion, as a former prosecutor, how outrageous do you find that on the part of the lawyer versus just lawyerly spin? Because the judge, in a way, did say there was no evidence of collusion because there was no allegation of collusion.
Yeah, it's pretty outrageous. I mean, you know, I don't think it broke any ethical laws that apply to lawyers, but, you know, he just got a tongue-lashing from the judge about essentially misrepresenting what the case was about and what the judge concluded, and there he goes out again and basically says the same exact thing that the judge had just dressed him down for saying throughout the course of the case. So, you know, and he's not stupid, you know, it's not that he didn't get it, it's that he has a different goal in mind, and the goal is not to accurately represent what this case was about and what the result of the case was. So, you know, as a lawyer, I think it was incredibly outrageous behavior. I don't think there's really any remedy for it, but, you know, he really should be embarrassed for himself.
And
Brian, could I just also wanted to say to this question of is the Mueller investigation over and this question of no collusion, the judge said very clearly, you can't say no collusion because this is an ongoing investigation yesterday. So clearly there are things that she knows. She has seen all of these filings unredacted. One filing that was misunredacted, meaning that you could see what was below the redaction, said that Paul Manafort had met with this person that Mueller believes is a Russian spy and gave him polling data. So there's some more to come that we don't know. Now, does this mean the Mueller investigation is or is not wrapping up? Unclear. They are black box. But there's some things that we don't know as of yesterday per Judge Amy Berman Jackson. Who knows what we don't know?
That's one of my favorite trivial moments of the entire Mueller investigation is the miss unredacted document.
Yes.
Like somebody needed a better Sharpie. and so we were able to see that Manafort gave this polling data to Konstantin Kilimnik, who's, you know, believed to have ties to Russian intelligence. But Jennifer, on the very fact that there was no collusion-related charge in the Manafort cases to date, does that indicate that Mueller isn't actually finding illegal conspiracy with Russia in the Trump campaign? Because if Mueller was finding it, with what we know about Konstantin Kilimnik's connections with Manafort and Manafort's presence at the Trump Tower meeting and all of that, you would think that collusion, illegal conspiracy version of collusion, would have run through the very Russia-connected Paul Manafort.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, you know, we don't know whether there's another indictment or something coming, but Manafort appears to be done with his charges. And, you know, there were a lot of people with Russian connections in the Trump campaign and lots of connections, lots of contacts that we've now learned about. But Manafort was one of those with the most, you know, the deepest contacts. So, you know, it is fair to say that if there were collusion that is chargeable collusion, that Manafort would have been one of the likely people to have been tied up in that. So, you know, it's not that there's absolutely nothing to the argument that it's meaningful that he wasn't charged with any sort of conspiracy crime that's along the lines of collusion, you know, but they certainly misrepresented the status of his case and what it was about and what's going on. And there was a lot of shady behavior without question on the part of Paul Manafort with these Russians and Russian-backed Ukrainians. So, you know, there's a little bit of fairness to it, but still the misrepresentations were pretty outrageous.
Andrew, your take on the same thing, like, why wasn't Paul Manafort charged with something collusion or criminal conspiracy with Russia related? And if he was in charge with that, what does that tell us that Mueller may or may not have?
So I think we honestly won't know that until the investigation is finished. There are some very big missing pieces of this puzzle that we don't know. One of them is what was behind the redactions in the Manafort filings. One of them is Michael Cohen has been testifying before the House Intelligence Committee behind closed doors, as we know. And the explicit reason that the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, who clearly wants to have all of this out in the public, the chair of that committee, has said is to protect the investigation. So I don't think this is quite wrapped up. They're also, if I'm not mistaken, I'm pretty sure Rick Gates hasn't been sentenced yet. So that's
that's
big
right.
question mark.
Manafort's deputy, who was presumably involved in a lot of the Ukraine stuff,
who pleaded guilty a long time ago. So it's sort of unclear what is going on with that. So, you know, point taken of what Jennifer is saying about the, you know, the sort of conclusion of this Paul Manafort case. But in terms of the broader Russia investigation, we don't quite know. Nor, I mean, you know, I suppose there's a possible legal theory that Paul Manafort, who is going to be in jail now or in prison until he's a very old man, has, you know, that the investigation has been taken quite far and that they're waiting to put together the other pieces for other reasons that are not revealed to us. But I want to stress the only source for this can be Mueller speaking through his indictments or through a report, and that every time, for I think almost since the investigation has started, every prediction about when it's going to end has been wrong. So we should take that into account as we sort of conclude when this is going to end. There are some signs that it's maybe wrapping up, but again, we just don't know.
And with Andrea Bernstein from our Trump Inc. podcast and Jennifer Rogers, former federal prosecutor and Columbia Law School lecturer, Mickey in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mickey.
Hi there. Thank you for your interesting program. I have a funny wrinkle to discuss with your good experts. While we condemn Manafort for the things he's been convicted of, tax fraud, we ought to stop and think how many people we all know who do whatever they can to avoid paying sales tax, including having items delivered to their friends in New Jersey, who buy things for cash in order not to pay sales tax, before we take such a high moral ground in criticizing what Manafort did.
I thought you were going to say buy things for cash, like college admission for their kids.
That's a different case.
We'll do that segment later in the show. Andrea?
I actually feel quite strongly, having sat through the trial, that this is not a matter of going to New Jersey to pay fewer sales taxes or buying something on the internet versus in a store. Number one, Paul Manafort was working for a brutal strongman in Ukraine. He was making tens of millions of dollars to help him win election. And essentially, the purpose of hiring Manafort was to keep the government of Ukraine from renationalizing the steel mills, because the people there were starving and there was a political movement to do that. That's what Manafort was hired to do, and in fact did do. So he made tens of millions of dollars. Making tens of millions of dollars, he did not declare that he was a foreign agent at times when he went to meet in the Oval Office with people. And he hid all this money from the IRS in very devious ways. So I don't think this is what some friends of the listener may have done, anything like this. And I think that there's been a lot of discussion among white-collar crime prosecutions are at a historic low. And there's been a lot of discussion among experts in this topic that if the federal government had been more on the case for years in both Democratic and Republican administrations, that it wouldn't have gotten to the point where Paul Manafort had committed crimes like this. And also, Michael Cohen committed crimes of bank fraud and tax fraud, let's not forget, that he pleaded guilty to.
And Mickey, thank you for your call. Jennifer, I want to pick up on sort of the same topic that Mickey's raising, which is comparative justice, comparing Paul Manafort and his fate to people in other cases. And I want to read you something that Chris Hayes said on his MSNBC show on Thursday night, and that is that there's a pre-Trump era racist, classist aspect of the way our laws are not applied equally. So, for example, he says to trace back the steps, many of the things that Paul Manafort was convicted of, tax fraud, bank fraud, he was doing in plain sight for years, and he wasn't even being investigated. And by contrast, he read a tweet from a public defender in Brooklyn who said, Manafort's 47 months in prison. My client yesterday was offered 36 to 72 months for stealing $100 worth of quarters from the residential laundry room. So how would you see Manafort and even white-collar crime of this sort, Jennifer, in, you know, big racial class justice terms?
Yeah, it's a really tough issue because our system is set up so that individual judges have a lot of discretion in sentencing, and of course individual prosecutors have a lot of discretion in how to charge. And short of trying to set up a system that doesn't take account of people's individual characteristics and the facts that differ kind of case to case, it's very hard to ensure consistency across cases in different geographical areas. I mean, years ago we had a mandatory sentencing guidelines in place that tried to do just that, put some consistency on this so that you didn't have poor people, people of color, suffering from getting longer sentences while, you know, rich white people got away with it, so to speak. The mandatory guidelines were declared unconstitutional, and so now we have more discretion, and I don't think people want to go back to the mandatory guidelines because that resulted in some very, very harsh sentences across the board without judges having the ability to go lower. But it's really hard to see a fix for this. I mean, we already have laws that protect against racial discrimination, but it's very hard, as I think Andrea said earlier, to get into somebody's head and try to figure out what they're thinking as they are, you know, issuing charges or imposing sentence. So, you know, it's a real problem in our society. I just don't really know what the fix is except for people to be paying attention, for journalists to kind of highlight what they think are outrageously high sentences, and, you know, hope for reforms based on categories of offenses, like, you know, there's been moves for lower drug sentencing and that sort of thing. But a system-wide fix, I just don't see what we would be able to put in place that would solve the problems that we're seeing. But I agree it's a real problem.
Howard in Hartsdale, you're on WNYC. Hi, Howard.
Hi. At what point does the clock run out? The middle of March, that the Democrats say that, you know, we're getting so close to the primary season, why put all of our energy into trying to impeach him when we can just nominate someone to get him voted out? I mean, it's already only 11 months to the primaries.
Well, that's a political question, perhaps, for the Democrats in the House. And, of course, one of the big political stories this week is Speaker Nancy Pelosi coming out and saying to the Washington Post that she's pretty much against impeachment, better to not divide the country through that process and defeat Trump at the ballot box in 2020. Remember that Watergate, you know, happened more quickly after Nixon's reelection in 72. He was out before the 1974 midterms, and here we are well beyond that. But people are interpreting Pelosi's move in different ways, Andrea, including the fact that she left herself a big, wide loophole there and said unless something really compelling comes to the surface, which means she too is waiting for the Manafort report to make this decision.
The Mueller report.
The Mueller, yes. Which might be a Manafort report in large measure. But yes, the Mueller report.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what members of the House leadership are saying both publicly and privately, which is, okay, I'm paraphrasing, but generally that's sort of what's the point of dividing the country further. A potential political backlash has been raised, as it was with Bill Clinton. Being impeached for him seems to have helped the Democratic Party. So there's a lot of caution, unless, as, for example, Gerald Nadler, who is the congressman for this district where WNYC is, has said that he and obviously the leader of the Judiciary Committee has said, unless there's a sort of groundswell among Republicans as well as Democrats, that is not the direction that he's going. But he has put in a pitch for bringing facts to light, and I am very much for bringing facts to light. And I think there's been a discussion that has been going on now for some time. As you know, we did a story in 2017 about how the same DA that indicted Paul Manafort chose not to indict Ivanka Trump and Donald Trump Jr. for felony fraud having to do with the way they marketed condo units in the Trump Soho Hotel condo. That got a lot of attention. The treatment of Harvey Weinstein got a lot of attention. There's been a lot of discussion. And I do think there comes a point at which all of this begins to be heard by prosecutors and judges who are people too, when these concerns are raised and raised and raised about are we treating white-collar, wealthy defendants the way we do poor, non-white defendants.
We actually have a comment about that very thing in Cy Vance's case from a caller. So let's take George in Bay Ridge next. George, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call, and I did learn it from Andrea. But before I get to Cy Vance, if I could just briefly say, if we could channel candidate Trump, who commented on Chris Christie, of course Donald Trump colluded. And just the facts of the Trump Tower meeting, Trump Moscow, Paul Manafort and Konstantin Kalimnik, whether Mueller can prove it or not, to me, we're going to have to find out. But of course he colluded with Russia to gain the presidency. There's no doubt in anyone's mind. And candidate Trump or citizen Trump would be the first one to say it if he was looking objectively at someone else.
Briefly, because we're running out of time, what did you want to say about Cy Vance in this respect?
Well, I think we should cancel the parade because, as Andrea just said, he had the goods open and shut with emails and all the information he needed on Ivanka and Donald Trump Jr. on fraud that any real estate person would have been charged with. So I'm glad that Cy Vance is doing what he's doing, but, you know, he missed the boat about 2 years ago when it had to be done, but it seemed like a third-party donation just wiped that out.
George, thank you very much. So, Jennifer Rogers, for you as a former prosecutor, does it look to you like Cy Vance is playing catch-up in the respect that George alleges? And did you have a take at the time once Andrew and company revealed the non-prosecution of Donald Trump's kids for what appeared to be a lot of evidence of shady illegal dealing around that particular real estate venture?
Yeah, I did. You know, my take actually was, and I should say I was a federal prosecutor, so we didn't do cases like this one, that they really would be state cases. But my understanding was that these sorts of cases, while you technically could prove the criminal intent necessary to charge a crime, was really not done that way. And so the thinking in the office at the time was more like, if we charged them, we would be doing something different in this case than we do in all of these other cases. It was essentially misrepresenting to potential buyers how many units had been sold and that sort of thing. And those were cases, I'm told, that were resolved by fines. And so that's what they decided to do here. And, you know, that was in line with how the office had treated those cases. Now, in the Weinstein case, it's a different kind of case because that's the sort of conduct sexual assault that, of course, the office charges all the time and doesn't resolve through fines. But those are very tough cases to make. And the evidence with the first case that they declined to charge was not strong enough for them. Now, he came back, of course, and has since charged Harvey Weinstein with more sexual assault allegations because additional witnesses came forward with what they perceived to be stronger evidence. It might also be the case that the public pressure brought after the first non-charge did play into their willingness to kind of go further, push harder, gather more evidence, and ultimately charge him. So, you know, I do think public pressure plays a role in these, but my sense of the non-charge of the Trump kids and the initial Weinstein case was that they were based on the evidence and the treatment of similar cases in the office at the time.
Well, what our 10 seconds. Reporting showed was that there were Vance overruled his own team. He concluded it shouldn't be charged, but that there were people in the office that wanted to proceed forward that thought there was a very strong case and that they did have the evidence.
WNYC's Andrea Bernstein, co-host of our Trump Inc. podcast, which first revealed some of Paul Manafort's real estate behavior that has now resulted in a charge by the DA office of Cy Vance in Manhattan, as well as on Cy Vance's non-prosecution of Ivanka and sibling. Which was it, Eric, or was it Don Jr.?
Don Jr.
Don Jr. And former federal prosecutor with the U.S. Attorney's Office here in New York, now a lecturer at the Columbia University Law School, Jennifer Rogers. This is not the end of history.
Thank you.
This is not the end of this story, but it is the end of this segment. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.